Hey Randy, I'm just having a bit of a freak out today.
What about?
Well, kind of everything, but you know, mostly my career. I just can't decide which step to take next and, you know, what I'm meant to be doing right now in my life. And I don't know, there's too many things to think about and too many options. And
come on, Lily, you're a prioritization expert. This should be easy for you. But of course, it's so much harder to do this stuff when we're applying it to ourselves, isn't it? It's easy to do it for work stuff, but applying it to life, that's hard.
So hard. But luckily, we have a brilliant guest today who has written not one, but two amazing books helping product managers to nail their product career.
Yeah, that's right. We've got Jackie Bavaro, and that was a lot of fun to talk to her, not only about that, but because she had one of my favorite metaphors for roadmaps that I've ever seen when we talked to her about charcuterie. And I just like saying charcuterie.
And for anyone who doesn't know what Randy's talking about, he's talking about a plate of meat. But anyway.
And cheese.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Cheese too. Let's get on with the interview. The product experience is brought to you by Mind the Product.
Every week, we talk to the best product people from around the globe about how we can improve our practice and build products that people love.
Visit mindtheproduct.com to catch up on past episodes and to discover an extensive library of great content and videos.
Browse for free or become a Mind the Product member to unlock premium articles, unseen videos, AMAs, roundtables, discounts to our conferences around the world, training opportunities, and more.
Mind the Product also offers free Product Tank meetups in more than 200 cities, and there's probably one near you. Jackie, welcome to the podcast. It's really lovely to have you here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So before we get stuck into our topic, it would be great to have a real quick intro into who you are and what you do in the world of product and how you got there as well. I love to hear an origin story.
Nice. So yeah, so I'm Jackie Bavaro, and I'm the co-author of Cracking the PM Interview and Cracking the PM Career. And in my career as a product manager, I started right out of school at Microsoft. And went from Microsoft to Google, where I got to start in the APM program and grow into get promoted out of it. And from there, I went to Asana, where I was lucky enough to start as the first product manager and grow with the company over time to become the head of product management there with a team of over 20 PMs.
Amazing. And what attracted you to product to start with? How did you decide that that was the career for you?
So originally, I had never heard of product management. And when, for my first job, I had a friend who said, Jackie, you should apply to this PM internship at Microsoft. And I said, I can't be a manager. I'm just a sophomore in school. And he said, it's not managing people. It's managing the product. You should just, I'm sure it's right for you. You should just go do it. And I was like, okay, but what does a product manager do? And he said something about writing white papers that didn't make any sense to me. but I trusted him enough to apply for the job. And through the interview questions at my first interview is how I sort of got a sense of what the job might even be. I was like, oh, you design things. You think about trade-offs. You prioritize things. And from that first internship, I entirely fell in love with the world of product. I'd always been the kind of person who's looking for problems in the world and thinking like there has to be a better way. And yeah. So finding a job where that gets to be your whole job was really exciting for me.
And one of the things that I thought was really interesting was you talk about kind of how you identify whether the product career is the right career for you. So what are your top tips for those that are interested or maybe have just started out and are kind of questioning whether this is the right move for them and the right role for them? What are your tips on like really kind of understanding whether it is the right fit?
So the key trade-off that you have when you enter product management is that you get to expand your influence and have a big impact on a lot of people, a lot of customers, more so than you could as an engineer, for example. But the trade-off is that you give up the hands-on work that you might do as an engineer or a designer. And so if you feel more motivated by having a large impact, getting to touch lots of parts of the product, and you're okay with losing the satisfaction that comes from building something and seeing what you built and having people say, thank you for building that, then you might really like being a product manager.
I think one of the things that really turned me on to product management in my early career was being able to be more influential over the sense of purpose of the thing that everyone was building. Have you experienced that as well? Like product management as being like this way of controlling or having a very strong influence on the purpose of what the team is doing?
Mm-hmm. Yes. As a product manager, we are responsible for defining the problem, for deciding what problem our entire team is going to try to tackle. What problem are we going to try to solve? And to me, I think that's one of the most important things you can do as a team, on a team. And one of the most reasons why product management is so valuable is that all of the people on your team are working so hard and putting all of their best energy towards creating something. And isn't it great if they can be creating something that solves a real problem that real people have? What I might say on the flip side is that some people enter product management because they think that they'll get to decide what problem the team goes after. They get to decide how things are going to go. And what they find is when you move to the product management role, you're actually extra accountable to many people on your team. People will constantly ask you questions or make you defend the choices that you've made or tell you that you're making the wrong choice. So you don't have quite so much power as a PM. It really is about your ability to understand the goals of everybody on the team and be able to show how a proposed solution will work for everyone and achieve the things that are most important to the team. You very much do not, as a PM, get to say, because I said so.
Jackie, you just said something, well, you said a bunch of interesting things, but one thing I wanted to come back on, you said that we're responsible as PMs for defining the problem that we're going to go after. What about delivering it? What about shipping it? We're always the people who stand in front of stakeholders and talk about what the strategy should be. And then they come back a couple months later and say, so where is it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So as product managers, there's the life cycle of the product is so important in what we do. And so you start by discovering the problems that you can go after. And then you define them. You narrow in on which problems are going to be the most impactful to solve and what slice of this large problem do we want to tackle first. Then you get into design where you're working with your designer. So your designer owns the solution from a user experience perspective. But as a product manager, you're still there giving feedback both as, you know, based on your knowledge of the customers and based on your knowledge of the goals that you're trying to achieve. From there, you get on to delivery, as you were mentioning, where it's really important to keep the team running, make sure the processes are set up so that people can break the work down into the small milestones that will help you see progress along the way and keep all the stakeholders up to date with how things are going. And of course, adjust things as they change. We can make all the plans in the world, but when we actually come down to the day-to-day of delivering product, new things arise. So as a PM, it's really important to use your product as often as possible, whenever there's a new release, whenever your engineers have a new thing they've built, to try it out, see if it works the way that everyone had imagined, and make adjustments as you learn. From there, you'll go on to the, I think we mentioned delivery, and this is where you'll work with marketers, write a blog post, do a launch checklist, do all the quality assurance, make sure everything's ready to get out the door. And then finally, at the end, you need to sort of debrief and bring it back around to the beginning. See how things went. What can you learn from it? Did it achieve its goals? And what are you going to want to build next time?
And I think one of the things that you mentioned as well, which I found really interesting, was the three phases of a PM career. You know, kind of very much that early phase starting with shipping and sort of focused on delivery, or more focused on delivery, perhaps in the second and third phases. So once you've kind of cracked, I guess, that first phase of your career of, you know, I guess being slightly more tactical and a bit more focused on delivering more tactical initiatives. What are the second and the third phases?
Yeah. So when I was a new PM, I did not realize how much the PM career changes as you advance. I knew that I was in charge of delivering great features that were going to delight customers and hit the goals. And I thought that's all there was. So I would look at the PMs who were much, much more senior than me. And all I saw of them was their spec reviews and the feedback they'd given me on my spec. And I didn't realize that they were doing any other extra work. And that makes it very hard as a new PM to grow and excel because I only saw a small slice of what the entire career was like. So one of the breakthroughs for me in really understanding cracking the PM career and how do you advance and expand your influence as a PM was learning that there's this new phase where in the first phase, success is delivering great products that customers love that hit the goals. But in the second phase, you're really responsible for product strategy. And this is creating strategies that will help you win a market and help your business and your company succeed. So here it's really about envisioning a future, an ambitious, inspiring future, and encouraging and influencing the people around you to want to go there and validating that idea with your customers to check that your inspiring future actually inspires the people that it's meant to. And then beyond that, there's a third phase. So you can get better and better at product strategy. And some people wonder, you know, I'm so good at this. I've now become a people manager, but why can't I break into the director roles? You know, what more could there be other than just getting better at strategy? But there's this third phase, which is organizational excellence. And this is where it really takes to grow to the director phases and beyond, stages and beyond. And that's building a strong team. That's, can you hire people and coach them and develop them and set up the processes and set up the company strategy and influence the other, the rest of your organization so that the people on your team can create great strategies and create great products. And that's really how you scale yourself.
Okay, that all sounds terrifying. I mean, I've been through that. I'm on the other side of it now, so I totally get it. But it sounds terrifying for someone who's just starting out. So let's talk about someone who's just landed their first product role. And we often tell them that, you know, there are defined roles, the engineers, the designers, the researchers on your team, they have very specific jobs that they do. And we often tell them that the PM kind of does everything else. Should they?
Yes. So the product management role is, I like to call it as a white space role. You need to fill in whatever space isn't being filled in by the other roles. And sometimes you do that by doing the job yourself. And sometimes you do it by identifying and defining that need and encouraging the rest of the organization to hire someone into that role. So both of them can have their own place. Sometimes there is a person who could be taking that role and your job is to help them envision the larger version of their job, to help them see how their role could be more than the narrow scope they've seen it as, but they could take ownership of something larger.
Okay, so you just mentioned encouraging people to grow into the needs that you have. Can you give an example of how you've seen people do that in the past? Because that's, especially for someone who's in their first PM role, that can seem a bit daunting.
Yes, I think that being able to influence people in other roles is a skill that you can develop as you get more and more senior. Mm-hmm. A lot of this comes from having conversations with your coworkers and asking them about what they love about their job, what the best parts are, what the worst parts are, what they're really proud of, what they're hoping to grow into. If you can understand the career goals of the people around you and like, what does it take for them to advance? What does success look like for them? You can often find these overlaps where something that feels like it would be tedious work for you is actually an incredible growth opportunity for them. So an example of this is that many people want to move into product management. And so you might have somebody from the user operations team, somebody who answers customer support tickets, who really wants to move into product management. And they're eager for any opportunity to start practicing those skills. And so you might talk to someone like that and ask if they would like to analyze customer support tickets and identify some themes and deliver a report to you on that. And then you can always, in addition to giving them that opportunity, one of the nice ways to get the most out of these is to combine the work that they did with extra exposure for them. So what I mean is that if somebody from customer support writes an amazing report for you on all of the top themes they're seeing in customer tickets, you can invite them to give a talk to your PM team and maybe sit in for the rest of the PM team meeting so they get a chance to really see how PMs do the work day to day. So they get exposure to the kinds of meetings they wouldn't normally get exposure to, and they get this growth opportunity. So from their perspective, it's a big win. And from your perspective, they've really helped you by taking off some of the load that you as a PM might have been spending your time on otherwise.
And just kind of thinking about the scope of the work and how that changes throughout the PM career, you know, just thinking about sort of making use of other people within the business as one potential strategy, how have you kind of managed your time so that you can do the job that you're doing, but also learn that next step and not feel completely overwhelmed by all of the work and all the time that it takes in order to do that?
Mm-hmm. So time management is a critical skill for product managers. And early on in your career, the day-to-day work of running your team does take up your entire time. Early on in your career, you'll write a spec and then you'll need to iterate on it and then iterate on it again and then persuade somebody about the ideas. And then, you know, a few weeks later, you finally come to an agreement on how to move forward. Or you'll work with your design team and you'll come up with a great design and you'll bring it to user sessions and something will go wrong and you'll need to go back to scratch, start from the beginning and try again. As you improve as a product manager, those iteration cycles get shorter and you catch many things earlier so that you're able to save hours and days and weeks of time on the same type of work. So maybe you'll have noticed the usability problem before you've been brought it to customers and you'll be able to jump straight to the new design. So that's one part of it, is just getting, as you practice the skills of the job, it takes much less time to get the day-to-day PMing of feature work to finish all of that work. Beyond that, though, the work that a product manager does will always expand to fit the time that you have. And so what I find works really well is to draw a pie chart of ideally where you'd like to spend your time. And I use a pie chart because a pie chart can't go past 100% no matter how hard you try. So you won't talk yourself into being like, oh, if I just spend a few extra hours, I can get this done. So once you think about where you want to spend your time, you can assess where you are spending your time, compare the two. And then a tactic that I find works really well is to, for when you want to spend more time on something, especially things like strategic work, is to put a meeting with yourself on your calendar and block off 3 hours and say, I'm going to be working on strategy now. And then you need to sort of have the discipline to try to hold yourself to that time. And sometimes you have to play around with, you know, is it easier for me to really save this time if I use it at the end of the day or the beginning of the day? Are there certain things I can do to make sure that I don't waste all that time answering emails or something like that? But then when you can really block off that time and dedicate it to the important work, I also recommend to people that sometimes you can just pretend that you're out of the office. Turn off your notifications. Pretend that you got invited to a wedding and that you have to take the flight off. You know, sometimes there's some mental tricks you can do to help yourself feel comfortable taking that time that you need to take. And once you are a few years into your PM career, you really will be at the point where you definitely can afford to take that time off. But even earlier in your career, you could take that time off. One of the judgment pieces is figuring out, do I not have enough time because I need to strengthen my skills so I can get my work done faster? Or do I need to add more time blocks so I can make sure that work doesn't expand to fit the time that I give it?
Interested in boosting acquisition and driving product adoption?
Or perhaps you're focused on reducing churn and improving profitability.
Whatever the metrics that matter most to you, track them with Mixpanel, the most powerful self-serve product analytics solution.
More than 26,000 companies around the world, including Deliveroo, TransferWise, now known as Wise, Uber, Ticketmaster, and DocuSign, use Mixpanel to build better products.
And now you can too.
And the Product Experience listeners get $5,000 off Mixpanel. Visit mixpanel.com/MTP and enter code MTP5K to claim your offer.
So So I'm impressed. You're the first person I've ever heard make a good excuse or a good case for using a pie chart. That's fantastic. And I really just want to reference that we talked to John Cutler a long time ago in one of our earliest episodes, who made a very similar point about blocking out time. If you don't have time to think, then you're not doing the job at all. And that's a really, really important point. So thank you for making that. That leads to something else, though, something I see in lots of job ads, which always scares me, which is you need to have good product instincts. What is that? How do I develop those?
Yeah. So I like to think of product mindset as being the mindset where you have a habit of always thinking about the goals of a product and tying decisions back to those goals. And I think the word habit is really important here, because at any given moment, anyone can stop and say, what are the goals of this? What choice would help me work towards that goal? But what's really important for product managers is to catch yourself and realize here's a time that we should be thinking about the goals. And once you have that first part is product mindset, and that's the first part of product instinct. So that's really having this habit of saying the choices we make for our product ought to be related to a goal. They shouldn't be just because someone else told us to do it. And they shouldn't be just because I'm excited about the new technology or I think this feature would be cool. I should know what I'm trying to achieve with the choices I make. The second part of that is what we might call more of product sense or product instinct. And this is being able to have sort of the taste to understand what are good product choices and the creativity to come up with good solutions. And for both of these, actually for all three of these, I think the practice that you do to get better at this is to use and pay attention to lots of great products. So there's a process that people do called the product teardown, which is with a group of people, you can pick out a product and talk about what are the goals of this product and what do we think this product does really well. And even though it's called teardown, it's not really meant to be about what's negative. It's easy to talk about what's negative, but you don't learn as much from that. You learn more from saying, hey, look, this product does so many things wrong, but somehow it's still successful. What are they doing right? How are they succeeding despite all of these problems? And when you use lots of products and you inspect them and you get familiar with them, a lot of good things happen. One is that you develop that taste. You start to learn, you know, I don't like it when I get pop-ups when I'm using a website. And then you start to realize that I'm not going to design something that has pop-ups in a website. You start to get familiar with standards and the different sorts of UI patterns that good products use. So that might be recognizing, you know, the way that people use tab bars or different types of navigation or different sort of social media primitives, like having reactions on blog posts. And then the next thing that can happen is that I think that a lot of what we call creativity is cross-applying an idea from one domain to another. So an example I like to use is that I think that TikTok is an incredibly creative app, but the concept of user-generated videos has existed for a really long time. And the concept of an algorithmic homepage that you don't need to be logged in to start getting good recommendations has existed on Reddit for a really long time. And the concept of shortening the content you create, like going from a blog post to a tweet, has also existed for a long time. But by combining these ideas from different places, and putting them together, you get a product that feels creative and is creative because they come together and to be more than the sum of their parts.
I think that's really interesting. And do you practice that? Is that something that you should do kind of just on your own? Or is that something sort of best practiced with other product people?
I think that practicing with other product people is a great way to get started. I tend to be the kind of person who I have trouble with a blank slate. If I have to do something brand new the first time from scratch, I often think that I'm certainly not better at it than anyone else, and I might be below average on my ability to do something for the first time ever. But what I love to do is really immerse myself in some new thing that I'm learning. So if I want to learn how to do product, I will watch, you know, 10 people do product teardowns. I'll bring lots of people, pay close attention to what are other people noticing and how might I have noticed that myself. And the first time through, I'm like, wow, they saw all these things I didn't even see. And the next time through, I'm like, yeah, I still don't know how anyone possibly sees this. I had this experience when I was going through data analysis for the first time. People would pull up the experiment results, and it's just a page full of numbers. And somebody would look at that, and they'd be like, oh, clearly I can see what's happening out of this. Like, this that new users are struggling while experienced users love it. And I'm like, how did you know that? But by looking at it again and again and again and getting, you know, dozens or hundreds of examples, then a lot, when I see something brand new, there's elements of it that I'm like, oh, I've seen something like this before. And I start to pattern match. And that pattern matching is really what becomes, pattern matching becomes instinct.
Is the product teardown really that much different from what designers do with the regular design crit? Or is it essentially the same process, or is it a bit different?
So design crit is usually on the designs that the designers themselves have done. Product teardown is taking any great product that's in the world. And I recommend do it on products that are similar to yours, like competitor products, but also products that are entirely different than yours. If you're in the consumer space, look at the enterprise space. If you're an enterprise, look at consumer, look at marketplaces, look at free products and paid products, look at products that everybody uses, look at new products that are the best in what they do. The more that you look at, the more patterns and interesting insights and interesting ideas you'll see. And that just builds up your internal library of solutions.
Okay, so completely different topic, but very, very poignant, I think, when we're thinking about the PM career. At some point in your PM career, and possibly at multiple points through it, you will probably suffer from some form of imposter syndrome. So what's your, how do you recommend people work their way through this? And what's your kind of experience with helping product people through this?
So I think that lots of really wonderful product managers have imposter syndrome. And the way that I've seen this be a problem is that as product managers, we always have more to do than we possibly have time to do. And so some product managers try to improve their confidence in things by spending more and more time iterating on work before showing it to someone. Or, you know, instead of doing 7 user studies, doing 14 user studies. And all of these things on their own could be a great way to improve your confidence in something so that you're ready to get it into the world. But because we don't have infinite time, the time we spend doing that takes away from something else that could be really valuable. So a few things that I found work well is basically to lower the barrier to sharing your work with other people. And so that can mean finding someone friendly who will take a look at your work and, you know, give you a pat on the back and say, like, yes, it's good. You can send that out into the world. Could be one of them. A trick that I use is almost any document that I send out to people, I'll say, here's a really early quick draft of some thoughts that I just threw together. I barely even like thought about it. Please, any feedback at all, welcome. Let me know if it's on track or if I should just totally throw this whole thing away. And with enough careful words like that, I can set the expectations quite low on what I'm sending out so that if it turns out that I was wildly off track, people will tell me. And they won't be afraid of hurting my feelings, and I won't feel like my own credibility is tanked because I put something sloppy out into the world. I've really lowered the expectations there. Mm-hmm. So a few things like that can really help.
That reminds me of the chat we had with Matt LeMay a couple months back about his one page, 1 hour idea of never spend more than an hour and never do more than a page before you show it to somebody else, because you may be wildly off track, and getting feedback and being collaborative is the essence of everything we're doing.
Yeah.
So moving on, one of the key things that we have to learn to do is to make decisions with imperfect information. How do we develop this skill? How do we get better at it? How do we make better decisions? How do we make them faster?
This is a really good question.
This is probably an entire episode in itself, but just getting started with it.
Yeah. So how do you improve your decision making? So I think the first step to improving decision making is going to be adding some sort of structure to your decision making. So this is something that I like to call articulate your frameworks. And when I say articulate your frameworks, I don't mean use an official framework like Porter's 5 Forces. I mean that whenever you have a decision that you're trying to make, you have some reason that you made that decision. So instead of just telling people, instead of sharing the end decision you made, share the thought process that you went through to get to that decision, and ideally write it down. And over time, focus your energy on how can you improve that that framework that you wrote down. How can you make it more generalizable? Or if you learn that you make a decision and it was wrong, how can you adjust that original framework so that it would have output the right answer? So by writing something down, you now have something that you can iterate and improve on. And by sharing it with people, you can get feedback at the framework level instead of just at the decision level. And the feedback that you get at the framework level is what will really help you improve your thinking and improve your mental models.
Okay. And one more question from me about one of the talks or the presentation that you did. So charcuterie boards and roadmaps, what do they have in common?
Oh, charcuterie boards and roadmaps. Yeah. So I think that a great roadmap is like a great charcuterie board. And what I mean by that is that a great charcuterie board is really about having a good balance between having the best meats and the best fruits and the best cheeses. And you wouldn't create a great charcuterie board by stack ranking all of the meats and cheeses and fruits together in one list. And if it turned out that it was all fruit on your board, like that's what you give to your guests. And the same thing applies to roadmaps. You shouldn't take the work that is working towards long-term engineering sustainability and scalability and try to stack rank it against a new feature that's going to bring in lots of revenue and stack rank that against an iteration on a current feature that's going to help user retention. What works a lot better is to think about your goals at a high level. Think about what percentage of your energy do you want towards each of these goals. So, you know, maybe your revenue is your fruit and your new user features are the meat and the engineering sustainability is the cheese. And now once you have your percentages, now you can fill in each of those goals with the top work that you want to do, because it's much easier to stack rank within a goal than to try to stack rank across goals.
You're making me very hungry, but I love the way you've articulated that.
I definitely know people who would make a charcuterie board just with salami. They're in my family.
Okay, I've got one last question for you, Jackie. Thank you so much for doing this with us. But as people go up in their career, one of the things that they're often faced with is starting to hire other product managers. And being that you're the person who literally wrote the book on cracking the PM interview, I want to turn the tables on you and ask it from the other side. When we start to interview product managers, what mistakes do we make? What do we need to do to be better as somebody, as a hiring manager?
Great question. So the most important thing when you are hiring PMs is to take some time with the team of people that the PM will work with and think about who do you want in this role? What skills are important? What experience is important? What kind of a space do you want them to fill? And once you have a clear idea of what kind of a PM you want to hire, you know, is this a very experienced person who is excellent in product sense and strategy? Or is this a more junior person who's going to really focus on the execution and increase the bandwidth of the team? Then you can get really intentional about the kinds of questions you ask and the kinds of signal you look for, as well as paying close attention to what kinds of things can you train people on and what kinds of things are harder to teach people on the job. So I tend to split things into three categories. One of them is things that you can teach people in 10 minutes. And if you can teach someone, for example, what an A/B test is and how to use it in 10 minutes, then I wouldn't test in an interview whether you know what an A/B test is, because then you'll weed out some people who could be really talented product managers and just never happened to work at an online company before. In the middle group, there are things that can be taught, but they take time. So I think about, you know, how to work well with an engineering team. That's sort of the core of what product managers are usually learning over the first few years of their job. And if I have the bandwidth and the senior mentorship to help bring on junior people, I might be able to hire people who don't know that yet and invest in training them on those skills. Mm-hmm. But I might have a team where I need someone to hit the ground running, and then I really would want to evaluate in the interview if they had those skills. And then the finally are things like mindsets and traits. And those are things that I think people can change if that's what they want to dedicate their lives to, if that's what they really care about. But as a manager, I can't force somebody to change. If somebody really doesn't like products and doesn't care about the details of products and what good design patterns are, I'm not going to be able to force them or train them how to like that. That's something that really has to kind of come from inside. Same thing about like intellectual humility. You know, somebody who's open to listening to others and hearing points of view that might contradict what they have. People get better at that all the time, but I wouldn't count on that as a hiring manager. So once you have those ideas of what you're really looking for, then you can design an interview process that checks for the different signals. And for the most important ones, you can have more than one interviewer look for that signal so that you can calibrate with each other. And I guess that's the final part I would say, is that when you are new to hiring PMs and along the way, calibration after each candidate is incredibly helpful for improving the skill of your interviewers. So for example, if we have two different people interview for product sets and one of them says they were wonderful and one of them says they were terrible, we can start to dig into the details of what happened in those interviews and see, you know, why did these two people get such vastly different signal on this? And are we asking the question in a confusing way, or are we missing a way to probe in deeper?
I love that. One of the biggest things I've learned in hiring myself is I can teach you frameworks. I can teach you techniques. I can't teach you to care about customers. I can't teach you to have basic stakeholder management skills. I can develop all those things. But if you don't have empathy and in curiosity, then I can't make that work, at least for the roles that I've been hiring for.
Yeah.
Jackie, thank you so much for joining us today. This was absolutely fantastic.
This is wonderful. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Jackie.
So, Lily, after that, are you ever so slightly less freaked out?
I'm definitely always much more chill after I've had one of our podcast interview sessions. I just love all of our guests. They're full of wonderful knowledge and advice.
Well, hopefully you all listening think the same, and you'll be back next week for another wonderful guest.
See you then. Our hosts are me, Lily Smith, and
me, Randy Silver.
Emily Tate is our producer, and Luke Smith is our editor.
Our theme music is from Hamburg-based band POW, that's P-A-U. Thanks to Arne Kittler, who runs Product Tank and MTP Engage in Hamburg, and plays bass in the band, for letting us use their music. Connect with your local product community via Product Tank, our regular free meetups in over 200 cities worldwide.
If there's not one near you, you can consider starting one yourself. To find out more, go to mindtheproduct.com/producttank.
Product Tank is a global community of meetups driven by and for product people. We offer expert talks, group discussion, and a safe environment for product people to come together and share learnings and tips.